then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 26th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Last week, I asked a question on the Homeland blog, kind of a survey-type thing. And the question is, what do you want to see on Radio Free Northwest over the next year or so? What do you like? What do you dislike? What are your suggestions for content, so forth and so on? Now, while the movement is not and cannot be a democracy of any kind, that doesn't mean that I don't need you guys' input. After all, to a certain degree, we're selling a product, and so we need consumer feedback, if you'll pardon my lapse into capitalist jargon there. Now, the responses were in many cases predictable, but they generally boiled down to several things. First, you want more local news about what the front is doing here in the homeland. I agree it would be great if we could have whole episodes of Radio Free Northwest devoted to specific areas of the homeland and specific local units, so forth and so on. Now, there are several problems with that, however. For one thing, and I have always been honest and open about this fact, we do not have anywhere near as much local community activity going on up here as we should. This is why I keep banging my head against a cinder block wall trying to bring it about. Remember? You guys won't get your asses up here and do these things, legal, political, and PR activity, the things of the very kind that you say that you want to hear me reporting on. Now, not that we don't have any activity at all going on here in the homeland. We most certainly do. In fact, this weekend we had the first ever Northwest Front literature distribution in the Longview and Kelso, Washington areas, although so far it hadn't gotten any media publicity. That's another thing I need to talk about later on in this podcast, the media blackout on the NF. But the fact is that we don't have the kind of boots on the ground that we should have up here, because you will not respond, and you are not willing to undergo personal risk and inconvenience for the Northwest American Republic, the personal inconvenience of laying aside your American dream and taking up the Iron Dream. The first step of which is to get your ass up here where the hell you're supposed to be. Now, one reason that we don't have as much to report on Radio Free Northwest as we should do is that you guys are out of position. You come to me and you say that you want action. I say to you again, for the umpteenth time, that you can have all the action you want with the Northwest Front, but you have to make it yourself. Now, I was chatting with one of my old comrades over the weekend who remembers some of the old groups I ran for a while, like the NSPA and CNC and NSWPP Mark II, and he pointed out, Harold, you're at the same point now that you always reach, the point where nothing can move forward until these people who claim to believe as you do start to respond. And he's right. Now, my biggest problem has always been that I've never had an actual organization behind me. I've always had an audience. But this time, it's the real deal, and we're running out of time fast. Now, somehow, I have to find these magic beans that will fast-forward the tape, if you'll pardon the string of metaphors. And I've found them. You people are the magic beans, and I've dropped you on the ground. Now, wrap your minds around the Northwest idea and sprout, damn you! Every week, I beg you people on bended knee to get up here and do the very thing that you claim to want to hear on Radio Free Northwest. And that's the rub. Entirely too many of you are still looking for entertainment, or you view the entire movement as a form of entertainment. You want to turn on your TVs or your computers, and you want to see and hear all this stuff happening on electronic screens, done by others, for which you will laugh and applaud and send a little money, but that's not good enough anymore. That's one way that you could encapsulate the challenge facing me in the NF right now. There are thousands of you now, and somehow I have to find some way to turn you from an audience into a, well, I won't say organization because that gets into something else we've been nattering about over the past couple of weeks, but I need to turn an audience into a movement. Literally, I need to get your asses in motion from wherever you are to up here. Okay, dragging myself back to the responses I got from the What Do You Want for RFN survey that I put up on the Homeland blog, most of the responses were pretty positive and helpful. For the record, I did not approve all of the comments for the blog because some of them would have, how can I put this, generated heat rather than light, and they would have started up another long round of
space madness.
But I did read them all, and I absorbed their content. There are some people who don't like Andy and Gretchen and Olivia and Lord Lucan. They say these guys are boring and they just want All Harold all the time with a few music breaks. There is a reason for these other people being on the show. It's been a while since I've gone over this, so I'll take another shot at explaining it. I don't mind spaced repetition. I know it's part of the job, since there are always new listeners who haven't heard this before. These days, everybody and his dog in the movement has an internet podcast. But it wasn't always so. I'm old enough to remember the pre-internet audio precursors to the web, which was either shortwave radio or more often bulk-produced cassette tapes. Now, some groups, notably the John Birch Society, had so-called local activity, which consisted of chapter meetings where all the little old men in suits and the blue-haired ladies would sit in some suburban living room and nibble cookies and sip their tea or sometimes their martinis, and then the chapter leader would haul out a boombox with a cassette deck on it, and he'd play a cassette recording of Robert Welch's latest bloviations from Belmont, or in the case of Willis Cardo's various fronts, they'd play something from Michael Collins Piper or whoever was shilling for Cardo at the time. Now, it would be something vague about insiders or Illuminati or the Federal Reserve or Mattoids or fluoridation or how everybody was a commie or else whatever the latest conspiracy theory was, and all these people would sit there like zombies with their slack jaws hanging down, listening to the word from on high, coming out of this machine like it was from Ming the Merciless or the voice of Oz the Great and Powerful. And then once the cassette was over, they'd all write a check and go off into little corners and gossip about each other. And if it was a John Birch Society event, the commissar from Belmont, every chapter had one, would circulate in these little corners and make sure nobody was talking about the Jews. And not so much Cardo's populists or whatever he was running at the time. I have to admit that Willis has never objected if his people use the J word as long as it's only in private. Sorry, I'm rambling again. Anyway, in years past, I got roped into a few of these get-togethers, and I always found them excruciating. The one thing I don't want, and which the NF can't have, is a situation where once a week, I, and only I, get up and rant and rave for an hour, music breaks or no music breaks. The Northwest Front is not, and cannot be, and cannot be perceived as nothing but a one-man band. There must be other voices on here besides my own, so that everyone, including the assholes from the FBI and the Justice Department lawyers who are listening, will understand that they're dealing with a movement and not just some single guru-type figure. Well, sort of a movement, anyway. That's why I keep hammering on you people every week, and yes, I admit there is a bit of self-interest involved in this. I don't want the secret police getting the idea that they can just take me out and then this whole Northwest thing will just go away. Now also, some of the comments which I did not approve regarding Gretchen and Olivia were downright misogynist. Okay, I get that. Now one of the most common denominators among all the white men and boys who gravitate towards the movement, the NF and all the rest of it, is that they have been betrayed, devastated, and destroyed by the women in their lives. Now this is arguably the most common negative experience among white men in general in American society. More common than job or economic loss to affirmative action, more common than bankruptcy, more common than arrest and enslavement by the prison industry, more common than losing everything to foreclosure or the Obama depression or medical bills. I get it. Been there, done that, as some of you know. I understand that the majority of white women are basket cases, and I do remember the old Norse proverb which says that all evil comes from the corruption of women. No argument. But the fact is that more and more white women are starting to realize what's been done to them by political correctness. And we have to encourage that any way we can. More and more white women have woken up and found that they are miserably unhappy in this brave new world that feminism and the Democratic Party have created for them. And we have to reach them and convince them to change sides and come back to us. It's only natural that most of the people who are attracted to the Northwest Front will be male, because white males are the main group of people who are getting so royally screwed by the Democratic state. And you can make that both big D or small D. But humanity comes in two genders, and we cannot be in male-only movement, just as the Northwest Republic can't be some kind of Neanderthal males-only nation where women are kept barefoot and pregnant and chained to the stove, which is how the left-wing liberal propaganda portrays us. Now, this is the reason for characters like Rooney and Nightshade and Eric and Annette, Edeem Poor Kicking McGee in my novels. They are white women who have come to understand what they have lost, who understand now what has been done to them and by whom, and who want to return the favor. We need to bring our racial sisters back to our side, because they've been cohabiting with the enemy in every sense of the term for way too long, and we have to change that. It is important not only that there be other voices than mine on here, but that some of them be female voices. And if that sounds almost like affirmative action in a quota system, I suppose it is, kinda. But I think all of you are capable of understanding what I'm saying here. Now, it's true that Andy and Olivia and Gretchen and Lord Lucan may not be professionally trained actors or broadcasters or performers any more than some of the other people who have appeared on here. But that's important, too. Radio Free Northwest isn't just the voice of white people. It's the voice of real people. The kind you might meet on a bus or on the street or shopping in a Safeway. The kind of people who are never afforded the opportunity to be heard anywhere else. Now, one of the things that we have to do is get ordinary white people participating in politics, and that includes speaking out, literally, on Radio Free Northwest. Now, there's your solution, just like it's the solution to most bitches and moans about me and the Northwest Front. Your participation. If you guys are getting tired of Andy and Olivia and Gretchen and Lord Lucan, then you need to step forward and give me something to fill this hour with besides the sound of my own voice. I again solicit from you people MP3 audio files between 5 and 8 or so minutes in length, talking about pretty much anything you want that's racial and has at least some tangential relationship to the Northwest Republic. I will say to you people again, dead serious. If you don't like the way I'm doing things, or the way some of these other comrades are doing things, then don't just carp and bitch, and don't just weep and wring your hands. Step forward and show us all that you can do better, and you can take that as an invitation. Okay, one of the responses I did get was that you wanted more comedy in the music sections. Now, that's kind of hard because, if you've noticed, one of the many aspects of our culture is that the Jews and the lefty libs have taken over during the past few decades has been comedy of all kinds. Now, they made sure of that because they understand what a powerful weapon comedy can be and how dangerous mockery might be if it's ever turned on them. And so they make sure that they control who laughs at what and who gets to set the parameters of what's funny and what isn't. Anyway, the fact is that most comedy in this country is now non-white or Jewish, and the few white comedians who do survive in the field are mostly Southerners who make a living by running down the South and affirming liberal stereotypes, kind of Southern fried step-and-fetch-it types. Now, one of the last white comedians who dared to get even a little bit politically incorrect was the late Louis Grizzard. This is one of his stand-ups from the late 1980s.
I'll be honest with you, what really confounds me today are all the movements. We got so many, everybody's involved in a movement today, you know? Some minority group, some special interest group. But you do what I do for a living. I write a column 4 days a week. And I got to pay attention. And I've never seen so many movements today. The gay movement gets me a little crazy. Do we have any gay people here, by the way? Because I mean, I don't want to embarrass anybody, you know. A lot of gay people in Atlanta. And they all have jobs as waiters. You ever notice that? Oh, really? You walk in one of them spiffy restaurants, one of them places where they put too much sauce on the food and don't cook the green beans. They cook the tomatoes and they don't cook the green beans. What is this? And you walk in, and I can't mention a name in them places because that would be libelous, okay? But the it's one of them, I guess. Don't say I said that, all right? No. But you all been, and you walk in, you know, and you ain't bother nobody. You just standing there, and one of them fruit flies spots you. Come sashaying. Walking about this far off the ground. You ever notice that? Looked like they're trying to carry a corn cob without using their hands. You know? I believe I got my people tonight. But no, you know, you've been through it. You've been through it 100 times. You're standing there, you know, and a guy comes over to you, and he always say the same thing. Hi, I'm Keith. I'll be your waiter this evening. I never know what to say. Hi, Keith. I'm Lewis. I'll be your customer, you know. As far as I'm on go, though, Jack, I guarantee you that.
Last week, I received a letter from one of our prison comrades who was transferred from an East Coast prison to the hellhole in Victorville, California, where Edgar Steele is being held. He wrote to me that Steele is in pretty bad shape. He recently underwent surgery, most likely for his severe heart condition, and he's now confined to a wheelchair. More than this, I couldn't figure out from the letter, and I don't want to identify this prison comrade, but I got the impression that Steele is being kept away from the actual yard and Gen Pop itself, since they don't want the embarrassment of having a 68-year-old white man in a wheelchair beaten to death by L.A. gangbangers right under the guards' noses. But that's no help to Ed in the long run. I will try to get an update on his condition and pass on anything I get to all you inherently criminal and violent types in the audience. That's a Bill White joke, by the way. Ed's appeal was heard in July. It's now almost October, and there is, of course, no news. I think it's pretty clear they're just waiting for him to die. I am going to play for you the last 15 minutes or so of Edgar Steele's second State of the Revolution address, which was podcast in March of 2010, almost 3 months to the day before the dictator's servants came and took him away. The ConspiracyPenPal.com website is still up, last time I checked, but as I recall, this is about the last really substantial audio piece Edgar Steele ever did before he was defunctionalized. Now, I know that I already played portions of this section on the podcast before, about 6 months ago, but since this is kind of Ed's last bow, I think we can put up with a partial rerun. Now, I have to admit that this audio creeps me out, because you have to bear in mind that by this point in time, in March 2010, the informer Larry Fairfax was doing his snooping and silver-stealing thing, and he was probably on the property just as this was being recorded, maybe hiding beneath the window of Ed's study or peeping around the door at him. Eww.
Welcome back to Edgar Steele's Nickel Rant. As I said before the break, we're now going to examine in detail the powers granted to the federal government by the U.S. Constitution. This is going to be easy and it's going to be quick because there are precious few such powers. Now, this isn't complicated, folks. I'm a lawyer, a constitutional lawyer of sorts, in fact. I've studied the U.S. Constitution in detail. The federal powers are few, carefully delineated, and limited in scope. They can be listed on less than a single sheet of paper. Let's review them together. The powers granted to Congress by the Constitution in Article 1 are 1. Collect taxes. 2. Borrow money. 3. Coin money. 4. Raise and support an army and a navy. 5. Declare war. 6. Set up a federal court system. 7. Establish rules for the naturalization of foreigners seeking citizenship. 8. Fix standard weights and measurements. 9. Establish post offices. 10. Make copyright and patent laws. 11. Govern the District of Columbia. And finally, 12. Punish treason. The president's powers are governed by Article 2 of the Constitution. They are even less. 1. Veto legislation, which veto may be overridden by a two-thirds majority of Congress. 2. Appoint ambassadors, judges, and a variety of civil officers. 3. Enter into treaties, but only with the approval of Congress. 4. He is the military's commander-in-chief. 5. Grant reprieves and pardons for crimes against only the federal government. 6. Inform Congress as to the State of the Union. 7. Receive ambassadors. And 8. Ensure that laws are faithfully executed. That's it. That's all he can do according to the Constitution. And finally, the federal judiciary is granted power by Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution to decide all cases involving the federal government or existing between states or between citizens of different states. Period. No power is granted to interpret laws applying solely to a single state and or its citizens. And that's it. That wasn't so bad, now was it? You didn't hear anything about abortion, did you? That's because it's an issue for individual states. Nothing about gun crimes, nothing about drug crimes, nothing about securities crimes, nothing about free speech or religion, nothing about most of the topics covered by federal legislation, in fact. That is because it all is reserved to the states or to the people as their individual right. All of it. Not some of it, all of it. After all, that was the whole point of the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, called the Bill of Rights. If an area of federal regulation isn't on the list that I have just given you, it is ultra-constitutional and technically and actually null and void. Good luck living your life under that presumption of reality, though. George W. Bush sometimes was brutally honest, as when he said of the U.S. Constitution, "It's just a goddamn piece of paper." Now that's the way that most feel today, unfortunately. And today, some of the states are beginning to bristle about excessive federal regulation and taxation, particularly that promised by the Obama administration. New Hampshire's nascent states' rights legislation goes the furthest in declaring certain actions by the federal government to be null and void, calling repetitions a breach of the peace that risk nullifying the Constitution. Now, New Hampshire's proposed legislation goes on to declare all acts of federal Congress that exceed the powers I enumerated for you directly before this to be void and of no force. Will this recent move by some states result in a modern-day secessionist movement? Some think so, but don't count on it. Don't forget what John F. Kennedy reminded us in 1962 in a White House speech. He said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." I honestly think the time has come to discuss secession and rebellion openly, though. That's why I honestly am considering attempting to garner the Libertarian or Constitutional Party nomination for governor of the state of Idaho in the 2010 gubernatorial election. My platform? EdGov, not FedGov. Would they allow me a real shot at the governorship? Of course not. But it might prove enlightening, and I guarantee you that it would be entertaining. The people who killed America. None have said it better than David Rockefeller himself, founder of the Trilateral Commission, a Bilderberg member, and a board member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He said in his memoirs, quote, "Some even believe we're part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it." Close quote. I consider it ironically symbolic that after 50 years, Marvel Comics has decided to kill Captain America. Literally killing. who stood for everything good in America since the start of World War II. It's just too bad they didn't depict the Trigger Man as being David Rockefeller. Everything relates to the New World Order, one world government, globalism, whatever you want to call it. Everything that is wrong with America today, everything that used to be so right about America, ties back into that single objective. America's preeminence must be destroyed so that she can take her place as just another country under sway of the globalist, self-chosen elite. Recall that while Bush the Elder introduced NAFTA, the beginning of what Ross Perot once called the giant sucking sound of American manufacturing and employment exiting the country, Bill Clinton signed NAFTA into law. Other alphabet soup organizations and agreements, for example, the WTO, NAU, ad nauseum, have continued to expand upon the pattern and objective of NAFTA. Clinton oversaw the systematic dismantling of American military power and allowed her secrets to be given over to America's future enemies, primarily China, both directly and through Israel. Bush the Lesser has overseen the destruction of American international influence and her domestic impoverishment. Obama will preside over the postscript. American self-determination, also known as nationalism, is being subverted by the mechanism of unchecked immigration, which dilutes the electorate, disempowering traditional white voters by replacing them both at the polling booth and in the workplace. It merely is a welcome bonus that our ruling corporate fascists thereby tap into a vast source of cheap labor, too. Thus, General Motors offered buyouts of remaining hourly employees last year so that they could be replaced by the cheaper labor that was allowed to flood into the country. It doesn't matter a great deal in the case of GM anyway, because its days clearly are numbered. The elite don't care about the rest of us, the crime, disease, poverty, and hunger. After all, they live in exclusive gated communities, mostly abroad. Who are they? Check the Earl at this point in the transcript of tonight's Nickel Rant for a list of their names. I sincerely hope that someone will post their home addresses for our use when the time comes. The Axis of Morons. Bill Clinton once observed, in a rare flash of honesty back in 1988 while visiting Ireland, "You know, by the time you become the leader of a country, someone else makes all the decisions." Close quote. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid allegedly head up the legislative branch of government, both of whom ascended to their current positions following the last midterm elections simply because the American people overwhelmingly demanded change and an end to the war in Iraq, not because of anything inherently worthy about their politics or leadership. However, the fact of one-party government was belied by Speaker Pelosi almost immediately when she put aside any possibility of George Bush being impeached for his many high crimes against the American public. U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts heads up the judicial branch, which has become as much a rubber stamp of executive action as anything ever seen under Franklin Roosevelt. And the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank is private, not federal, has no reserves, and is not a bank in any sense of the word, and it's the most direct and open expression of the globalists, who own its stock through complicated, nested, international, mostly foreign, corporate arrangements. More than anything else, it is the monetary policy of the execrable Fed, now headed by Whirly Ben Bernanke, but which did most of its damage under the leadership of Alan Greenspan, that is destroying America. Monetary policy is a euphemism for legal counterfeiting, since it's the expansion of the money supply, the one trick of the Fed, that really has led to the impoverishment of Americans, both now and off into the future, by pure and simple theft. The fourth estate is best exemplified by media mogul Rupert Murdoch of Fox News, the stronghold mouthpiece of the new corporate elite, and others. Though every single media outlet of any significance is owned and operated by members of the same group about which Bill Clinton spoke. All neocon, all Zionist, mostly Jewish, traitors to America and our blood enemies, every single one of them. The people mentioned in these past few minutes, and just a few others, ladies and gentlemen, are the problem. They constitute what I call the axis of morons. It takes a towering intellect to build a towering house of cards, but all card houses have one thing in common. They fall. It is my fondest dream that one day we might witness their trials and public executions for the treason, genocide, and theft they committed while invested with the public good. After the break, we'll talk about what we can do about what's coming at us. Welcome back to Edgar Steele's Nickel Rant. Depression II and World War III are coming. In fact, I believe that history will record that both already have begun. For my complete take on both, as well as their causes, please see my book, Defense of Racism, which can be previewed and ordered at www.defenseofracism.com. In addition to the upcoming unpleasantries of war and economic apocalypse, add the likelihood of global disease pandemics, both natural and man-made, which will result in the globalist's desired population reduction. I foresee a 20 to 80% population decline throughout, concentrated primarily in the poorer sections of the world. I see things ramping up ever more quickly from here, with things reaching a fever pitch no later than 2012. In fact, it could all be over rather quickly if global thermonuclear war develops, as I think likely, but with a mop-up period of abject misery that lasts for generations. What can we do? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Elections are useless in America to affect local, state, or national change, as now proven. If you must vote, vote against all incumbents, right down the line, including Dr. Ron Paul. If he hadn't had that congressional slot to which to return, he might have proven more adventurous in his recent abortive attempt to be elected president. The international cake already is in the oven and will explode no matter what we do. The dollar is doomed, and there is absolutely nothing that anybody can do about it. As I said at the outset, we're screwed. Violence? Much as I'd love to say go get 'em and bring me their heads on pikes, truly, there's only one answer that I can give. Absolutely not. Anything else, of course, would get me arrested. Besides, it still is too early. Violent and or illegal acts done now simply would serve to delay the time when the average American will be willing to throw in his or her lot with ours. Notice that I assume you already are on the same page as I, since I doubt that hardly anybody not already there, other than our enemies, of course, will be listening to these words. Again, refer to my book, Defense of Racism, for active preparations. As in real estate, items 1 through 3 are location, location, and location in that order. Get yourself out of the cities and into the country, in a region that will be safe from whatever about which you might be paranoid. I'm paranoid about police state action, financial devastation, infrastructure breakdown, nuclear strikes, nuclear fallout, racial strife, earthquakes, volcanoes, tidal waves, and hurricanes. Not necessarily in that order. That's why I live in North Idaho, one of the very few areas in America likely to be free from, the initial effects at least, of nuclear fallout, in the country with a well and a little acreage on which we grow livestock and could grow modest crops. Next, arm yourself well, with plenty of reserves of ammunition, to protect yourself and your family. Bury some of your guns as gun confiscation is coming. Next, put up substantial stores of basic foodstuffs, enough to get your family by for a year, ideally. Plant a garden. It'll take at least 2 growing seasons for you to overcome your major misconceptions and mistakes and begin to produce real food for your family. Farmers will tell you that it takes 10 years just to get past most of the mistakes. Finally, protect yourself financially if you're fortunate enough to have any money left over from the real priority items. Get out of all dollar-denominated assets and into something designed to weather the coming financial storm, which already is in progress. Check my archives for articles aplenty on this topic. Cultivate like-minded friends, but avoid those who advocate violence or who might seem a bubble or two off center. Don't worry about federal agents. They're everywhere. Live your life right out in the open. Keep your head down and do nothing illegal, and you likely will avoid their wrath, if not their pettiness. Our day will come, rest assured. All too soon. The day they start shooting us down in the streets. The day we start shooting back. Then will be the time to retake America. Then will be the time to even scores and settle accounts. Then, and only then, can we begin the long journey back toward freedom and a constitutional republic. New America, an idea whose time has come. My name is Edgar J. Steele. Thanks for listening.
3 months later, Obama's gunman came and took him away. There's a very good DVD now on the Edgar Steele case called Witness to the Persecution. They don't update their website very often, so I don't know what the price is, but you can contact the Edgar Steele Defense Fund, P.O. Box 1255, Sagal, Idaho, 83860. That's P.O. Box 1255, Sagal, S-A-G-L-E, Idaho, 83860, and you can ask for further information on the price. Now, I have seen this DVD, and it's well worth whatever they're asking for it. This is the Old Blind Dogs.
Oh, and never will I marry be until the day I die, since the raging seas and stormy winds parted me, love and I. Oh, as I went out one May morning down by the riverside, my shadows bare and trees to bear, alas, to be me bride. Oh, alas, to be me bride, me boys, the chambers to behold. I'll never ever forget my love, a jolly sailor bold.
Okay, I was going to talk to you guys about some other stuff at this point, but this morning I got this hysterical, screaming email from a person whom I know only by an internet handle. Now, he's a regular commenter on the party blogs, and that's all I know about him. I'm not sure even where he lives, but judging from his email, he's a young white man or a man approaching middle age, and he's trapped in poverty on the East Coast someplace. Anyway, this person gave me another chorus of a song that I've heard often enough before, from what we call the T-shirt youth, i.e. young white males, and nowadays a few girls as well, who either come here or want to come here with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs and $10 in their pocket. This is what he has to say. Dear HAC. Okay, I added the Dear HAC. Actually, this just came in as one long screaming sentence. You just do not or refuse to understand that it is not as simple as just jumping on a bus for all of us. In case you haven't noticed, white people can't get jobs, therefore can't get money. It takes money to move down there and live. Let me try to explain it in simpler terms. No money equals no migration. No brown skin equals no job. Does that make sense? I cannot understand for the life of me how this is so damn hard for you guys to understand. Do you want us to come live on the streets up there? I won't give this guy's email handle because I don't want him to think that I'm singling him out, but basically he's pretty much typical of the attitude of the T-shirt youth, or some of them anyway. This is going to get a bit sensitive here because so many people in our wee little movement have skins as thin as tissue paper, and some of you are going to think that I am personally insulting you and running you down, which is not the case. When I am talking about somebody specific on here, I will name them. If I don't name anybody, then I'm not talking about anybody specific. I am observing or discussing a phenomenon or a problem, and I do that a lot, but let's move on. First, let's talk about the T-shirt youth. These young, single men who want to come here with $10 in their pocket and the T-shirts on their backs, and that's it. I hear from guys in this position a lot, and this is where it gets sensitive, because they kind of act in a certain way which I don't really like talking about because it generalizes, and it may not be applicable to all of them, and it sounds like I'm running them down, and some of them may not deserve it. But here goes. Basically, becoming a T-shirt youth seems to be what happens to white boys when they've been kicked out of their parents' basement, or who never had a basement to live in the first place. Most T-shirt youth of my acquaintance have been typical white boys who basically dicked off in school because of the niggers and the general stupid nature of the American educational system. White boys who never learned a trade, or in some cases, who dropped out of school because the nigger situation was so bad, which, to be fair, I probably would have done myself if my parents had let me. So basically they end up on the street, or one cut above being on the street. Because they find themselves in their 20s and early 30s, unskilled, with no trade and no way to make a living. No safety net, stuck in some East Coast or Midwest city, surrounded by niggers and muds and having to compete with them economically, and all alone in a world that should have been theirs but which no longer belongs to white men. And maybe a bad marriage and a divorce or two in their past already. Kind of reminds me of long stretches of my own youth, except some of those times for me were in foreign countries where I had a nationality and immigration problem as well. So please, please, do not think that I am unsympathetic. Then they find us, or some other movement group, and they come running. And I have no doubt at all that they are perfectly sincere in their burning desire to serve the cause of racial resistance. God knows they should be, since they're on the sharp end of the stick, and this baby shit brown tyrant in the White House is swallowing their souls like some kind of python. But some of these t-shirt guys, not all, seem to think that willingness to serve the faith should also translate into the loaves and fishes, or the cakes and ale if you want to be Shakespearean about it. This was a problem, frankly, that Pastor Butler had a lot in the compound up at Hayden Lake. That bunkhouse was a magnet, and some of the people it drew were substandard. Now, I've talked about those magic beans that some of you people seem to be convinced I'm hiding in my pocket. Well, in addition to the magic beans, some of you seem to think that we have a magic carpet as well, and we can just descend from the skies over at Cincinnati or Milwaukee or Texas or wherever you're stuck, and whisk you away to the homeland where you will move into Harold's guest room or some kind of bunkhouse and live happily ever after, sort of a white nationalist version of the dictator's EBT card and food stamps kind of deal. The idea that someone is going to take care of you all your life and that you will never be expected to survive on your own. And yes, I am acutely aware of the fact that without you guys' help, I myself would now be living under a bridge with my computer in a shopping cart. This wee little movement of ours abounds in irony. Okay, look, for those of you who are in the same position as the guy who emailed me, and you are not in Andy Donner's position of having a highly marketable skill that's much in demand, let me tell you how you migrate. This is how I migrated back in 2002, more or less, except my job was a cut above minimum wage. First off, son, you get your ass a job. Yes, I know it's hard. Yes, during my own stints of unemployment, my many, many stints of unemployment when I was living on rice and beans and Spam sandwiches, it enraged me to the point of madness to have some asshole tell me to get a job, like it was just something you could get up one morning and go out and do. God, that made me angry. Of course, that's also how I ended up working for Pinkerton on a number of occasions. I don't know if this is still valid. It used to be back in the day when you had to have a job that afternoon you went into Pinkerton. That was my first job the first time I came to Seattle. I was walking by the office. I figured, hey, I'll go in and put in an application. That was at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was on site at 11 o'clock that night. Anyway, I'm telling you this because that's your starting point, the job. Nothing can begin until you get a job of some kind, and you think life in your little ticky-tacky furnished apartment or your trailer's bad now? Wait until you can't pay the rent and you're living in a Salvation Army mission. I never fell quite that low, but the closest I ever came myself was in Texarkana, Texas, and I was 46 years old. In those days when I labeled my emails as being from the computer in the crack house, I wasn't kidding. That'll give you an idea of where I was living. I say yet again, I understand where you're coming from, but you're going to have to be the one to pull yourself out of it. We can't. We just don't have the wherewithal. Now do what you have to do to get that job and get some kind of paycheck coming in, even if it's going into goddamn labor ready every morning at 6 o'clock and sitting on a folding chair drinking watery coffee, waiting for some truck to come around and take you out to a construction site to pick up scrap lumber and crap. Now, when I lived in Carrboro, North Carolina, in the mid-90s, I was a madrugador for a while. I would show up at this one convenience store, which everybody knew about, at 6 in the morning, and I'd hang out with the Mexicans in the parking lot, waiting for day labor jobs, mostly at that citadel of liberalism, the University of North Carolina, who pretty much ran their whole landscape and janitorial departments on illegal labor. Now, those of you who have read the first Matt and Heather Redman novel, Fire and Rain, well, that's how I supported myself when I was writing that book. But I'm wandering off topic. Now you get your ass out on that street and get that job. It doesn't matter what you have to do to get it. All's fair in love and migration. Pretend to be a faggot or an Indian if you have to get on a quota. In some parts of the country, Indians are especially rare. Now a lot of times, a desperate white boss who has a minority quota to fill will hire a white boy if you're willing to check the box claiming that you're an Indian and you both just hope that no federal inspector ever comes around. Okay. You get your crappy little minimum wage job, Or, thanks to Obamacare, you get your two crappy minimum wage jobs at 29.5 hours each week, and you spend 1 year working and saving every goddamn penny you can. You will need to arrive in the homeland with a functioning automobile and at least $2,000 in your pocket. Three would be better, although I myself had less. You can do it in 1 year if you have enough determination to spend all your waking hours that you can working. You just resign yourself that for that 1 year, all you're going to do is work. You can do it if you have enough self-discipline to disconnect your cable TV at $75 or $100 a month, whatever you're paying, and stay away from the convenience store and the six-pack of beer on your way home, and instead you come home at night to whatever little grungy flea bag you're living in, and you sit down and you read library books instead of staring at an electronic screen. You can do it if you spend your money on three things besides savings: rent, a bare necessary minimum of food, and whipping your old beater car or truck into shape. As always, you are the magic beans. There is no magic carpet that will descend from the skies to whisk you away to the bunkhouse and the full refrigerator in the homeland. We don't have any kibbutzes up here like they've had in Israel, and maybe that's on the cards one day, but not now. But where there is a will, there is a way. Our pioneer ancestors did this, and yes, some of them fell short. But it is so much easier now than it was in the days of the Conestoga wagon. Now, I myself have made cross-country moves repeatedly in the past 20 years, and at a much older age than most of you t-shirt guys. What can I tell you? It can be done. I never ask anything of you that is beyond your strength. You just have to find that strength. Anyway, for a third music break, let's go back to comedy for a bit. Here's a kind of a t-shirt youth song that one of our guys sent in. I'm sorry, I do not know the name of the performers, but I think this is pretty apropos for the topic at hand.
Let's do that one we made up about the Obama scam pain.
Oh, Mr. Scam Man.
Scam Man, yeah. Mr. Scam Man, where is your dream? I thought my life would be all peaches and cream. Now I don't have a job and I'm out of money. And moving forward, things don't look too sunny. Scam Man, I'm so alone. Don't have a mortgage to call my own. So much for the roses and the clover. I'm using food stamps to feed a rover. Mr. Scam Man, we need a cure and not a worldwide apology tour. You're tearing down our country's good reputation by trying to make us an Obama nation. Scam Man, hey, don't touch a thing. Take more vacation time and work on your swing. We need a president a little wiser than a community organizer. Bum, 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 bum. Oh, bummer. Scam Man, we can't forget. You promised you'd reduce the national debt. That's what so many millions gave you their vote for. A change of your address is all we hope for. Scam Man, hey, you're breaking our backs. Is it a penalty or is it a tax? Only half of us are paying our share. That's fair. He don't seem to even Obamacare. We all say no, no, no Obamacare. Yeah.
Hurry up, November 4th.
Can't get here soon enough.
Amen.
Okay, look, I had not intended to spend this whole podcast on what might be called internal matters, but right now there's plenty of rants and raves out there on the internet about Obamacare and Syria and whatnot, and right now this is what we need to hear. I apologize for the fact that hostiles of various kinds are overhearing it as well, but I've explained that before. This podcast is where our main target audience congregates, and this is what we have to use. Now, for many years, Northwest migration in practice meant hop on a Greyhound bus for Hayden Lake, Idaho, and go hang out with Pastor Butler and the boys in the bunkhouse where the fridge was always full of Budweiser, or at least full of Old Milwaukee. A few years ago, we had a female comrade in Montana, whom I will not name, but who a lot of you probably know, who took the same approach. Now, this lady had a guest room, and her migration pitch was simple. Come to my hometown in Montana, and rack out in my guest room until you get on your feet. Now, I warned her against it, and as so often happens, I was right, and now she hates me and attacks me on the internet because I was so rude as to prove her wrong. Typical movement soap opera. Yeah, people really, really don't like it when you're right all the time. But before she began to leap and whirl in the goat dance, this lady and I collaborated on writing a leaflet, which is a standard piece that we still send out with every introductory packet of Northwest Front literature. I am not going to sit here and read you the whole leaflet, but I will go over some excerpts from it. The leaflet is called Homecoming, Etiquette and Expectations. From the excerpts I will read, you can get some idea of the problem posed to us by certain elements among the T-shirt youth, and the problems that this lady in Montana experienced by simply opening up her guest room to internet walk-ins. Okay, I'm quoting now. Any time that people come together for any purpose, there will be bumps in the road and unforeseen problems that will come up. To avoid many of these problems, a set of rules of etiquette or expected behavior needs to be established by the party for newly arrived PSA or primary settlement area residents and for newcomers in general. If we all understand what is expected of us, then we will be able to work together more effectively. Okay, like I said, I'm not going to read the whole thing, so I'll skip over the first section. Next section is expectations for those who come to the homeland. The basic rule of homecoming is simple. Plan and save. Don't show up on somebody's doorstep here with $100 in your pocket and the T-shirt on your back, expecting to be taken in, fed, housed, and supported by comrades who in most cases are almost as tapped as you are. Don't expect a free ride. We understand that some people coming to the homeland might not be in a strong financial situation, since we are all in the middle of the Obama Depression. Nevertheless, we expect you to pull your own weight, like the early pioneers did. With the economy the way it is, realizing that it will probably get worse before it gets better, the party knows that some of you will need help when you get here. That being said, you need to realize that none of us are rich, and that we can't provide money or accommodation beyond occasional temporary overnighters in someone's guest room. Pastor Butler had a bunkhouse. The party does not as yet, and it will be some time before any such facility exists, if ever. You must come prepared to become self-sufficient as soon as possible. Now, by doing this, you'll open things up for another person to be helped in your place, as well as take the strain off people helping you get settled. Now, we have not yet won the War of Independence, and the homeland is still part of the United States and the capitalist system. You must come prepared to compete in the job market. You must spruce yourself up. Clean yourself up, cut your hair, hide your tattoos, wear a nice suit for job interviews, and if necessary, be prepared to kiss some muggle ass for a job, just like you would anywhere else. Accept this and be prepared for it. Bring warm winter clothes with you when you come, or enough money to buy them once you arrive. White people have become very climatically soft over the years, Californians and Southerners especially, demanding that it be hot enough to grow a palm tree in their room. That's not natural for white people. You will be coming home to the kind of climate our northern European ancestors lived in, and which helped to make our race great. Prepare for it. Bring transportation, a motor vehicle which is mechanically sound and functional, not some old beater on its last legs that rolls up burning oil and needing $1,000 worth of work. It is true that the major urban areas in the Northwest homeland do operate extensive public transportation systems. You can live in the cities without a car, although not comfortably. But in the two primary settlement areas, and most of the other areas of the Northwest, a fairly long commute to and from work is standard, and reliable transportation is an absolute necessity. Plan to try and help other newcomers get to the homeland. Make it a priority to get yourself in a situation to help other newcomers as soon as you possibly can. That will mean putting your private pursuits to the side and prioritizing the party in your life. True, we need incoming settlers, but even more, we need political soldiers for the Northwest Front, and the first pioneers must fulfill that role as a matter of urgency to build the party's infrastructure. Don't run your mouth about the PSA to locals, especially in these early stages of forming primary settlement areas, advertising what we are trying to do, throwing associates' names around, and being a loudmouth is a huge risk to the entire settlement enterprise. Don't show your butt. Do not engage in dysfunctional or bizarre behavior which will bring the party into disrepute. There is no reason to go out and run your mouth about racial politics at work or socially, except in the context of genuine and sober recruitment of carefully vetted local prospects. The first step in getting people to listen to your ideas and beliefs is to put yourself on a credible basis of communication with them by making them respect you as a person first, and then listen to your ideas. Now, this means, among other things, avoiding strange and unusual garb. No shaven heads, no extreme t-shirts, no brandishing of guns, no running around in camos in public parks frightening the little old ladies out walking their dogs, that kind of thing. Racial settlers in the homeland should blend in seamlessly with the local people. Avoid excessive drinking and partying, especially in public bars. This shouldn't even have to be said. It should be obvious that we can't accomplish what we seek by engaging in public drunkenness and making fools of ourselves. But apparently, this very simple message is a hard one to absorb for some of us. Anybody who thinks more of their beer can or their whiskey bottle than their race is someone we don't need. Respect the lives of those who are already here. Local party activists and white nationalists in general will have built relationships with Muggles in our towns as well as sympathizers. They hold jobs, go to school, and have reputations that they don't want tainted by drunken, dysfunctional dumbasses who have nothing to lose and who don't care whose nest they foul. When you come to a Northwest town with nothing to lose, you can screw up and then leave town and then go on to another place, leaving your former hosts to pick up the pieces and try to fix your mistakes. The horrible example of Jost Turner and N.S. Kindred comes to mind. The party must have zero tolerance for goobu movement crap. Act like a serious adult. The fact is that many white males in the society suffer from a serious inability to grow up. They have been deliberately socially engineered that way by the Jews. But somehow you must find within you the strength, maturity, and moral fiber to break with that conditioning. You are not children. We have serious work ahead of us, and acting like this effort is some sort of adolescent party is not going to help us achieve our goals. Okay, the blog post asking what you want to hear on this show is still up on the Homeland blog, and I'm accumulating enough material for several shows, but for now our time is up. So that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.